Begin after six taps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
You're listening to the FlixWise podcast, so get ready for the ride of your life. I'm your host, backup bloodbag, Lady P. No relation to Master P. Joining me today is the founder and editor of ClassicFilmFan.com. Ladies and gentlemen, here performing all her own stunts is FlixWise regular, Ms. Carrie Speck.
Wow, you didn't say anything about stunts. I have to rethink that.
I'm going to throw you off the top of this building. I hope you're okay with that.
We'll see.
And writing Harpoon in her FlixWise debut is filmmaker and action movie connoisseur, Miss Jenna Payne.
Thanks for having me. Yay. I don't get to jump off the building, too?
Well, we'll see if Carrie makes it. We need to do a second
take. I'm take one, you're take two.
Okay, got it.
Are you prepared for a hardcore, high-octane adrenaline rush? Seriously, so much freaking octane. Today's sight and sound entry is a nonstop, balls-to-the-wall action-adventure thrill ride. A movie so exciting, it manages to be both pulse-pounding and heart-stopping. A visual feast for the ages. Oh, and did I mention it's a nearly 90-year-old silent film? The 34th greatest movie of all time is Buster Keaton's 1926 feature, The General. We're going to talk about Buster and whether we think The General is his masterpiece. Then we're going to talk about the 21st century version of The General, Mad Max Fury Road.
Woo!
Yeah!
Okay.
It may sound a little outlandish, but many critics claim to see some similarities between George Miller's adrenaline-drenched auto escapades and Buster Keaton's railroad exploits.
Really?
Yeah. We'll see if we think these comparisons hold any gasoline. Yeah. Terrible.
Wow. I'm going to say that a lot, I think, this time.
They hold any gasoline?
No, wow.
Wow. What is happening? Finally, we're going to let our engines cool for a minute with a few final notes of positivity. All right. You both buckled in?
Mm-hmm.
Hell yeah. All right,
let's do this. Vroom, vroom.
I was going to ask you if you're going to add those sound effects.
I hope so.
Yes. Today's sight and sound entry is Buster Keaton's 1926 film, The General, a thrilling tale of adventure and romance, part Civil War epic, part circus act, with stunts so dangerous not even Evel Knievel or Tom Cruise would dare attempt them. Okay, maybe Tom Cruise. The film stars Buster Keaton as Johnny Gray, the finest locomotive engineer south of the Mason-Dixon line. Johnny Gray is a noble man with an acute appreciation for the important things in life. The important things being, of course, his woman and his train. The woman is Annabelle Lee, played by Marion Mack, and his train is the titular General, his pride and joy. All appears well in Johnny's life, that is until the pesky Civil War comes to town. Pressured by Annabelle to enlist, Johnny tries to join the rebel army, but he's rejected and sent home with no uniform. When Annabelle sees Johnny, sans Gray, she dumps him and leaves him dejected with no one but the General to console him. And just when you think it can't get any worse for poor Johnny, a group of Union soldiers disguised as Confederates kidnap Annabelle Lee and steal the General right out from under him. The remainder of the movie follows Johnny's hot pursuit of the Union infiltrators. Will his dearest Annabelle live to see another day? Will the General fall permanently into the hands of the enemy? Will the Confederacy emerge victorious in the War of Northern Aggression? The answers to all three of these questions lie in the small but sturdy hands of Johnny Gray. Okay, so do you like The General? Who wants to go first? Well, Carrie?
I love it. I always have since I first saw it in a film appreciation class at college, I think, let's say in the mid-80s, late 80s. And it was a lot of fun to see it with this general ed classroom full of jocks and English majors and psych majors and so forth, a variety of people who were there supposedly taking what they thought was an easy class. And they were all fascinated and they were all just laughing so hard, virtually rolling in the aisles with laughter and walking out of the theater just pumped with joy. That was such a great experience because we got to see it on the big screen, of course, and actually film when they still had it. I watched it again, of course, recently, and just love it. It's the comedy is still fresh. And I think the fact that it's a silent film actually helps it. Because this is 1926. This is just, what, a couple years before sound comes in to play. We all know Chaplin continued to make silence for a few years, but not Keaton. If this had been a sound film, I don't think it would be the classic film that it is today. It would be suffering from dated dialogue, which stands okay because of the fact that you're reading it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, being a sound film, they would have had to add a lot of dialogue, which I think would have, at that time, been creaky.
Yeah.
You need more time for the action, right?
You need more time.
Less dialogue, more action.
Right. Yeah, it wouldn't be the same if it had been a sound film. So I think the timing of it being made was perfect.
Okay. Jenna, do you like The General?
I liked it. I didn't love it. It's really cool to watch. Oh, I know. I'm sorry, ladies. It's really cool to watch stuff like that and see all the movies it influenced later. I took this assignment very seriously, and I rewatched, William Friedkin's Direly Bombastic to Live and Die in L.A., as well as Chris Miller and Phil Lord's 21 Jump Street.
Okay.
Which borrows heavily from this chase scene, actually. It does. It does. They keep switching vehicles.
Ah.
Ah, that old trick. And so it's cool to see, where that originated. But, many things, it's sort of having watched it through the filter of the more modern takes, sometimes it's hard to go back. But I laughed a lot. I have to say, the thing that...
Had you not seen it before?
I hadn't seen it before, actually. So I just watched it for the first time. And honestly, the thing was that the opening was kind of slow. Mm-hmm. I thought the comedy was really tepid at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And the setup. Once he was on the train, it was great.
Mm-hmm.
But up until that point, it was a little... It was slow going.
Okay. I agree with you there. Yeah. I think the whole love story is kind of not needed.
Really? No. I think it's adorable, especially when they, at the end, where it totally pays off.
And I agree. That last joke is awesome.
Dynamic.
And also when he finds her and they help the escape.
Exactly.
That whole bit with the mailbag is awesome.
Exactly. Right. Yeah.
But, she pulls the pin between the cars.
Yeah.
But that was kind of a relatively minor contribution for her as a character in the escapade.
Yeah.
But it serves to deflate him. It's one of the many things that serves to deflate him. Poor Johnny.
Yeah.
But he's always underestimating her. And I love that she, in the end, is able to figure out how to do things herself.
Yeah. And it was standard of the time to have that romantic setup to sort of say, oh, hey, this is what's at stake. They always did that in silent film comedies back then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't think it works.
You've got to save your woman from whatever.
From
or the prove
actually frequently a train.
Or prove to her that you're worthy of her love.
She's just lucky she wasn't put in front of the train.
Right.
Tied to the tracks.
Ta-da. Yeah. But Buster Keaton is my favorite of the silent film clowns.
Mine too.
Yeah?
Yeah,
so why do you prefer him over, say...
Chaplin? One, more variety of character, which sounds funny talking about the Great Stone Face.
Right.
But Chaplin, at a certain point, always relied upon the little tramp, which there's nothing wrong with that. I don't want to get angry calls and emails from people. But the fact that Keaton didn't rely on a single character allowed him to put himself in so many different situations, very much like Lloyd. But Lloyd, for me, was always just a little too big, a little too broad. I think the fact that he always had that stone face sort of allowed you to project upon him a much more variety of character. So whoever you were in the audience, you were allowed to make him more brave or more funny or more sympathetic because it was an empty slate. His face is always exactly the same. And depending on the frame that came before and the frame that came after, suddenly you realize what he's emoting.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I think he was beyond that too. He was actually really able to emote quite a bit through those eyes.
Absolutely, yeah. Right. He had such an expressive face, even though it stayed relatively still. And then even the small changes that he would make, they became really dramatic because
right.
he did
profound.
It so frequently.
Yeah.
Exactly. But Jenna, are you a silent movie person generally?
I'm not the biggest silent movie person. I certainly would say comedies are not my forte. I more like The Man Who Laughs and Metropolis and stuff like that. But
it's coming up.
Oh. I really appreciate Buster Keaton. I did love The Cameraman, and I love his cameo in Sunset Boulevard. yes. The old waxworks. Yes. But let's see. But I remember the cameraman being hysterical, just crying while I was watching it.
Mm-hmm.
And this one was not that funny.
Right.
But this one's kind of interesting in that it's perhaps is one of the first to cross genres and kind of combine an action adventure with a slapstick routine. And so
I wouldn't call it slapstick, though. I'd call it more like some maybe lowbrow comedy, but because some of the setups
but it's
are
a lot
really,
of pratfalls.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's definitely a very physical comedy.
It's a physical. Yeah. I'll say that. Yeah, but I would fight you tooth and nail to call it slapstick.
All right. I think there's room for subtlety here, but I think apparently critically it didn't do very well, and box office wise kind of a failure, and it was a very expensive movie. But I wonder if part of that wasn't that the audience had no idea what to do with it at the time.
I agree with you. Yeah. The train, sorry, spoiler. That one incident with the train that's pretty big was the most expensive explosion action thingy set piece that happened in the history of movies to that time.
Right. Well, I think even today, judging by inflation, it is still
considered
well ahead of most films.
Hmm. It would be interesting to compare that to the train crash in Harrison Ford.
The Fugitive.
Thank you very much. Yeah, because you know they crashed a real train in that one.
Okay,
they did.
Yeah. I don't know. I meant to look up by inflation, like how much what this budget would be today, but it didn't happen.
I don't think it wouldn't be. I think I did look this up. It's not in the triple million category, which is generally what we spend on movies these days. But that's actual practical stunts. It's probably up there as far as single most expensive set piece. Probably.
I feel an article coming on my part for my site.
Perhaps. I think someone needs to do some research.
I would love to hear about this. But and I did hear that they just left the bridge collapsed and the train there, and until World War II, they needed scrap metal.
The scrap metal. It's pretty funny.
Recycle, reuse.
Yeah, I think that is absolutely what happened at the time. Critics didn't know what to make of it. They went in expecting comedy, and turns out it was an action film
with some drama.
Yeah, there wasn't, the laughs weren't there. It's not as uproariously funny.
Well, when you get to a certain point, like he was, which was a pretty big star, if not one of the biggest stars in the world at the time, and people are always expecting a certain film from him and they get something else, inevitably people will be disappointed. Right. Had it not been Keaton, had it been somebody else and they gone in, it probably would have been a very successful film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I can see that.
Yeah. No, I mean, the first time I saw it, I mean, I liked it, but I didn't love it as much as some other Keaton films.
This was my first Keaton
film. Oh, okay, gotcha. Yeah,
he got you early.
Yeah,
with this one.
Yeah, because it's not as funny, and some of the stunts in Steamboat Bill Jr. or Sherlock Jr. is my absolute favorite. They are so amazing, and they're so elaborate. And that's not to say that the general isn't equally elaborate, but something about having a house fall on your head. you really get the sense of danger in some of the other ones is more acute, but I think he's putting his life on the line in this one as well. So
I just think some of the setups are pretty amazing because you're like, okay, where is this going? And perhaps that's also another reason why it wasn't successful with audiences or critics was it took too long to set up. They're used to quicker setups with Keaton and a quicker payoff and therefore more jokes because you can fit more in.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Whereas this, they had to serve the plot as well. And some of these setups, because you're dealing with trains that can only move so fast, like when it's under that bridge and twists around and comes up at top, I just thought some of them were just some brilliant. So when they paid off, I was like, oh my gosh, that's the funniest thing I've ever seen.
Exactly.
The amount of setup was really impressive. Mm-hmm. And another thing I was wondering, though, as far as audience appreciation, I was wondering why they chose to make someone from the South the hero in this. Because you're talking about there would still be a few Civil War veterans left over. And definitely some people alive from Reconstruction.
This would only be 40 years later. So
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
So.
No, I mean, I think the studio wanted him, or his producer wanted him to have the hero be from
Union.
The North.
Yeah.
And Keaton insisted. And in fact, Disney ended up making another version of the same story where the Union guys are the heroes. But I think it serves the story really well to have him be Southern because he's the little guy, he's the underdog. And with every victory, there's another setback. That's it's perpetually, one step forward, two steps back. And so even at the end of the film, where he emerges triumphant, it's this ironic, you know, the irony is that ultimately it's
not going to matter.
It's like, this isn't going to end happy for them.
I think you got a very good point there, because it sets him up as the underdog. And so if we had him in a Union uniform, people will be going, well, we know everything's going to turn out okay.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But because he's in a Southern uniform, it's like, well, we know, wait a second, what's going to happen here? Because we all know what happened at the end of the war.
Right.
But does it bother you that he's from the South?
No, it doesn't bother me. But I would imagine audiences of the time would have. Yeah. And this is, after this, he had to go on contract, and he was no longer an independent filmmaker because it was a failure. So
that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is kind of the last great Keaton film.
But I think he was right to do it.
Yeah.
You know, maybe at the time, and maybe up until the day he died, he might have thought, been rethinking it.
Yeah.
But as a film standing the test of time in history, he made the right choice.
No, this is his favorite film that he made. He thought it was his best work.
Oh, that's impressive.
Yeah. And I mean, so while other films may be funnier, I think that the action in this still really holds up.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
It's still really exciting to watch him, you know, chase after that other train. And I've seen this film before, but I rewatched it for the podcast, and I watched it with someone who hadn't ever seen it before and doesn't have a whole lot of interest in silent film. And he was riveted, too.
Yeah.
So this holds up for everybody. There's something in this for everybody. And I challenge anyone who thinks they don't like silent film to watch this one and then tell me what you think.
I think that you're right. Just make sure you make it through the opening.
Yeah.
Wait until he gets on the train before you make a decision.
Speak through that part.
But then you miss the part where he's on the, what's the spoke thing?
Yeah.
The wheel. And that's such a great, I was saying, like, has there ever been a better visual metaphor for dejection than Buster Keaton
stealing a penny farthing as his pursuit vehicle?
That was fantastic. I was waiting, like, did you add your own slide whistle to that? Because I did.
Yeah, totally.
But also, we keep talking about how this movie isn't that funny as compared to some of his other ones.
But it's still funny.
It's still funny, and it's sort of, it's such a dark subject matter that it's almost a dark sense of humor.
Well,
it's,
there's a lot of death.
Yeah, there's
some
a
of them
lot
are
of death
funny
in
deaths.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oops, this, you know, sword just flew off its handle and I killed
That's
someone.
That's exactly what I was thinking
was
of.
Hysterical.
And it's like, I don't know if you buy this, but it almost feels like a parody of Civil War epics, like he was making fun of maybe another dramatic epic that would have come out.
You mean something like Birth of a Something?
Maybe that one?
Yeah.
Perhaps, maybe. And I'm sure there were others of that ilk, you know. But the humor, because it is so subtle, and because he does seem to be making fools of a lot of the people involved with the war, do you think it functions as a Civil War movie parody and then maybe even a satire of war in general?
Well, to make a Civil War parody, that's a very fine niche market, so I would probably go along the lines of maybe more of a war parody. But well, that's interesting, because right before that one particularly funny moment is that the men around him are getting plucked off by this person, and it's like one after another, and it is funny.
Yeah.
But it's what, how many guys, I think, go down? Five or six before the ultimate payoff of the joke? It's put in a different setting. It's not very funny at all, is it? But maybe
rather sobering thought, actually.
Is there an example of a dark comedy before this time?
Of a dark comedy.
I can't think of something off the top of my head.
Well,
but
I mean, Buster Keaton has always been kind of morbid. Like, there was that movie he made where he tries several attempts. He makes several suicide attempts, and all of them fail.
That would be dark. Welcome, Harold and Maude.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm not sure if, what's his name?
Hal
Ashby has cited that film, but seems like a pretty obvious influence. Now I'm trying to think. So his big ones, just offhand, I would say The General, Sherlock Jr., Steamboat Bill, The Navigator. maybe Our Hospitality and College and The Cameraman, but he did so many others just within a really short amount of time. It's only really, what, 10 years or so?
I mean, you're coming off a time period where they were making them, the industry was making them, what, how many a week?
Yeah.
You know? Like, they would literally crank them out. Literally cranking them out.
Exactly.
And so transitioning to that period in the 20s, that was considered slowing down.
I don't know how you would do that.
And yeah, I can't wrap my head around it either. But yeah, I mean, up until the 40s, like, you'd be on a new picture every 4 weeks or something. Mm-hmm. So, like,
well, even during the studio system, especially during the war, the actors and actresses still were doing, they were being assigned, it's like, go here, you go here, you go there. Jane Wyman used to talk about how she'd be on one set in the morning, another set in the afternoon, and then something else in the evening, because that was her schedule and that's what she was told to do before she became a big star.
Right.
But even the big stars were doing three a year.
Yeah.
You know.
No, it's a lot of work and it's a lot of effort. And nobody these days puts out, I think, anything quite at that level.
Yeah.
No, it's usually years apart, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, especially for writers and directors. Mm-hmm. Like, they're pretty few and far between.
Yeah, the auteurs. Mm-hmm. We can expect a new P.T. Anderson film maybe 2 years if we're lucky.
Right.
You know, like, I guess that's how that goes. But I guess, you know, it helps if you don't have to come up with dialogue. It's easier to get. But that being said, like, Keaton came up with so many great gags. And Chaplin, too, and Lloyd. What a fertile imagination. Just keep coming up with jokes.
Particularly since they did churn them out so quickly.
Yeah.
It's like, well, how did you come up with something? Don't go, oh, wait, I did that one 3 films ago.
Right.
Oh,
exactly.
Wait, I did this one 7 films ago.
Exactly, yeah.
It's very impressive.
Yeah. But I'm wondering what it is about Keaton that I respond to more than Chaplin. And, like, maybe it's the situation, like, Chaplin seems to be begging me for my affection, whereas Keaton doesn't seem to care at all. He's like he's the bad boy.
He's
or something.
So cool. I just want him to like me.
Exactly. Is that all it is? Or is he just a stone cold fox? Is that I know.
You know when he's hiding under that table?
Oh,
he
that
looks
is my
pretty
favorite
sexy.
Scene in this.
With his hair wet. And, oh, it's kind of sexy.
I'm so glad. Way. Yes. I'm glad other people agree. Like, I thought I was going crazy. Like,
well, that
Buster
may
Keaton.
Be, but
that, well, yeah.
We're all in this together.
I know. Buster Keaton is beautiful. Mm. That's all
it
is.
Well, that black and white cinematography.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Oh, exactly.
Man. Also, let's just say the mustache is passing. Sorry, Charles.
Yeah. That doesn't fly anymore. So, as we mentioned, this was a commercial and critical flop at the time.
We did.
I mean, what do you think it says that critics are now, this is now the critical darling of the comedy, the silent age of comedy? This is the top ranked film of any Hollywood silent film. Well, I shouldn't say that because Sunrise is a Hollywood film. But mm-hmm. The only other silent films on the list so far are Sunrise and The Man with the Movie Camera.
Mm-hmm.
So, but this, like I said, the top ranked comedy. What does that mean? Why do you think critics have changed their minds?
Well, I would say hindsight is 20/20 in this.
Exactly.
And this was like a very cutting edge movie and is still relevant and resonant today that it, you know, is still sort of being ripped off for 21 Jump Street.
Right.
But
are you getting royalties from them or something?
They can call me anytime.
Yeah. Yeah.
But no, that in many, many action films, you can still see elements of this. And I think at the time, it just was too ahead of the curve to be appreciated.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Yeah. I also, there is something being said about when one well-known critic says something's really good and others jump on board.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't be surprised if in a few years we have that change.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you said the film's 90 years old. When did it suddenly become the darling? I would love to find out what date that was to see if it is cyclical or if it's something that's settled.
Mm-hmm.
I do believe that time and distance is needed for really truly evaluating any piece of art,
mm-hmm.
and especially movies, because movies is so young. So in 10 years,
we'll see.
When we see its placement on there, because I guarantee you Vertigo will not be at the top.
Yeah. Also, may I ask, why are you doing the BFI list instead of AFI?
Well, there's more variety on the the Sight and Sound list.
AFI,
yeah.
I hope you're not listening.
Well, and I think it's a good choice because it allows for more European taste.
Exactly.
Yeah. And which is a true...
to explore a little more.
Well, not only that, but it's like if we're going to talk about the history of cinema, let's talk about the history
all
of cinema.
Of yeah.
And that not just America.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, I wonder if there had been more interest if I just stuck with the AFI list. Also, I'd seen just about every movie on the AFI list. There are a lot of movies on the
BFI
list.
Yeah, I haven't seen.
So,
yeah,
same here.
I thought it would just be a good opportunity to explore more.
I think it's a good choice.
Yourself.
I was just curious.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, challenging myself. But so speaking of the Sight and Sound BFI list, do you think that The General is worthy of the 34th spot on the list? It is tied with Psycho.
You know, I think it would be fantastic if someplace like the New Beverly that does amazing double features did a double feature of all the ties on this list.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Can you imagine seeing Psycho and The General together?
That would be something.
That'd be awesome.
That might be a little jarring.
Yeah. I don't know. Really interesting.
They're both black and white.
Yeah, they're both black and white. That's about where the similarities end, I'd say. But
yeah. I mean, I have to say, personally, I prefer Psycho, but okay. I definitely see both of those as being like landmark pictures.
Okay. I guess I should give you what's ahead of it and what's behind it.
Okay.
Ahead is Bicycle Thieves.
Ooh.
Yeah. Okay. And I think there's another tie afterwards. Like there's a tie for 36 or 38. It's like Satan Tango. Oh crap.
What the heck?
Oh,
is
Metropolis.
Satan Tango?
Oh, Bellatar. It's recent. Yeah.
Satan's Tango sounds really promising.
And Metropolis?
Metropolis, yeah. Satan Tango is 7 hours long. It's slow.
Okay, no
Hungarian
wonder I don't know
slow
it.
Okay. Whoa. Cinema. Yeah.
Definitely hit.
Are you guys
the fast
volunteering
word.
For that episode?
No, I think I'm out of town.
Yeah.
I don't know when it's happening.
I don't either.
It's just not
I'm
available.
Pretty sure I'm out of town. In regards to its ranking, I have a feeling that you guys may not agree with this. Yes, it's not as laughable mm-hmm. as the other films that Keaton has made. I think it's more poignant. I think it's got more weight. Mm-hmm. It's more solid. And I'm not a big fan of Psycho.
Oh,
I
wow.
think that's overrated. I would throw that down the list. Probably around 50
that's
for me.
That's probably my favorite Hitchcock film, but whatever.
But you're young. You'll learn.
I'll learn.
Uh-oh. I certainly like The General better than Bicycle Thieves.
Okay.
Oh. As I believe we discussed in an email exchange.
That's funny because I like Bicycle Thieves even more, and I would throw that up the list.
Jen is on record as hating Bicycle Thieves.
Really,
wow.
really thought it was a snooze fest.
Yeah.
You have to come back, and we will have to talk about
it. But then
this.
She'd have to watch it again.
Yeah, and I patently refused. I was like,
if just come in for a cameo so I can prove how wrong you are?
You send me the link, and I'll listen to the show, and we'll see if you talk me into watching
it. So, but you're okay with it?
The 34
for The General.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really, without looking at the entire list right now, have like a huge concept of where it like
to make
lands.
A stand.
I, oh god, 34 pleases me just fine.
Okay, perfect. Carrie, what do you think? 34. I'm thinking, yeah. Is that too low, too high?
If I certainly wouldn't go lower. Okay. I'm not sure it. Again, I'd have to also double check the list. I've seen it, but it's not something that stays in my mind.
Yeah.
I could push it up the list. I could push it up even as high as the 25.
Yeah.
You know, I do think it's a strong film. I also think because it's an early film, and as we've talked, it's influenced so
super
many other films.
Mm-hmm.
So I think perhaps higher on the list.
Yes.
For me.
I'm gonna have to agree. I think 34 is too low for the first silent Hollywood silent comedy. Like
adventure romance.
Yeah. Yeah.
The first hyphenate film.
Yeah.
Yes, there we go.
Yeah, I can't believe there's no Buster Keaton film on the list yet. I can't believe there's no Charlie Chaplin film on the list yet.
True.
It's appalling, really. I know that The General is on the AFI list. City Lights is number 14 or something, 16, something like that, on the AFI list. No Charlie Chaplin yet. What are we doing here? And yet there's like 3 Tarkovskis, there's 3 Coppolas.
Mm. They've already done 3 Tarkovskis.
Yeah.
Those are awesome movies. I can't stay awake during.
No.
I'm sorry.
Oh, no. Well, maybe listen
I'm
to the podcast.
I'm on as the action connoisseur, okay?
There's lots of action in Solaris, kind of. There's... Maybe not.
We did emphasize this is a European list.
Yes, right. Yes, yeah.
Two Godards, and yet this is the first Keaton. And
well,
still
no Charlie
Chaplin.
Europeans, and I'm just going to make a blanket statement here, tend to be more artsy. Yeah. You know, the Americans
artsy. Keaton is very artsy. I guess, like, there's no question in my mind that there should be a Keaton film that is higher, whether it's The General or something else. I don't really know. Sherlock Jr. is my personal favorite, but The General feels like it's so modern, whereas I think it's aged probably the best out of any of his films.
I would agree.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's why that one is on the list.
Yeah.
And it definitely makes sense, even if, you know, modern sensibilities might demand that I have an action movie that I prefer more.
Yeah.
But it all came from this movie, and that's really cool.
Why don't we stop it there? One recent release that's been drawing a lot of comparison to The General is George Miller's Mad Max Fury Road. Fury Road is a 2015 reboot of the dystopian Road Warrior saga. The lead name on the marquee is Tom Hardy, who plays the aforementioned Max. But the real star of the show is Charlize Theron as Furiosa. The fates of Max and Furiosa collide through happenstance, and out of convenience, they decide to team up to rescue a harem of women from an evil dictator named Immortan Joe. Together, they lead Joe's men on a rip-roaring pursuit through a post-apocalyptic wasteland in hopes of finding a piece of Earth on which they can build a future. Much like The General, Fury Road is essentially one long chase sequence. We're going to see if we can find any other similarities between the two films and then hopefully talk more generally about what makes for a great chase sequence. Since this is a semi-recent release, I want to just warn listeners that we're going to talk about specific details of the film, though I really don't think there's any way to spoil this film. There's not much to spoil here, but be forewarned. Okay, so, Jenna, do you like Fury Road?
I loved Fury Road. Okay. I've already seen it twice in the theater.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
You've seen it twice?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Okay. Really, really, really loved it. And I believe it has surpassed True Lies as my favorite action film.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Throwing down the gauntlet right
there. Wow, okay. All right. Carrie, did you like Mad Max Fury Road?
Not for the first 20 minutes.
Okay.
I was sitting there going, what the heck is going on here?
Yeah.
And I remember leaving the theater, and I can't remember who said this. They said, well, it probably helps if you've seen the other films. It's like, I have seen the other films.
Yeah.
I was there when they came out. I went to the theater and saw the other films.
Yeah.
I actually don't think it's necessary to see the other ones.
No, it's not necessary at all.
Yeah.
I think the person just said that.
Was like a big Mad Max fan. It was like, I can't believe you don't get the movie that I love.
Perhaps, but I just felt,
I felt
the first 20 minutes was a mess.
Hmm.
And
okay.
That to start a movie, I hate movies that start out like that.
So we're talking up until the title credit comes where he's like trying to run away or like into Furiosa
leaving the Citadel.
Okay.
So it wasn't, it was not until she, I want to say after we see what her true purpose is,
mm-hmm.
That I'm like sitting there going, I don't understand what's going on. They haven't made anything clear. I know a lot of people think, well, it's not necessary. And I'm sitting there going, yeah, I'm so distracted right now.
Hmm.
I think it's necessary. Now, after a certain point, I was able to get into the ride and enjoy the movie.
Right.
But I have to say that's because of the exceptional talents of Tom Hardy and Charlize Theron.
Mm-hmm.
If you did not have these two people in the film, you would not have a film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see that.
This film, as we're recording this, has a 98% approval or fresh rating on Rotten Tomatoes.
Mm-hmm.
This is
I'm not surprised. Yeah.
Overwhelmingly positive critical reviews.
Mm-hmm.
And while I enjoyed the film, I'm a little baffled by its reception. I saw it and I was like, yeah, that was fun. That was cool.
I have to agree with you. I didn't know it was ranked so well.
Yeah.
And I did hear that it was getting critical acclaim and that audiences liked it. But I truly believe it's because of those two actors.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a decent, fun ride.
Yeah.
But honestly, we're not going to see this on anybody's critically acclaimed list.
But now
ever.
There's been all these, like, people are going back and looking at Road Warrior and saying that's a classic. And I rewatched the originals. They're not that good.
The first one is the best of the original series.
Okay.
I think, and I would actually say compared to the general, Thunderdome is the one we should really talk about with the train sequence.
Okay.
Although that is absolutely the worst of the original. Yeah. I like the first Mad Max a lot. The second one, I get how it's iconic. I didn't watch it in the 80s, and so it kind of I don't think it's aged that well. Mm-hmm. Like, I sort of understand how it builds that world.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Fury Road, far and away, like, blows that out of the water.
I will say, I think Fury Road is the best of the series.
I agree with that heartily.
Yeah.
Thunderdome is an absolute Disney fine.
Right.
No, that's it's an 80s film.
Yes. No. I like Beyond Thunderdome until they get to the Peter Pan part. With the hook part. Like, I dig that one until I get to the children. And the second one was smart enough to have the one child in the film not talk.
it got really bizarre. I, not only did Max destroy one, vestige of civilization, he destroyed two in Beyond Thunderdome.
Yeah.
He just did this beautiful green place where these children have built their own society and get along. And he just makes them want other things and leave their home and go, oh, it's ridiculous.
I'm not a huge fan of that series. So having heard all the great reviews, I went in with pretty high expectations. Can I talk about my main issue with the film?
Yes, please. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Okay. So this has been propped up as a feminist allegory.
Mm-hmm.
I could see that. I sort of buy it, maybe, kind of.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. My issue with the film is that in the beginning, it is set up so that we see the hordes of suffering people, including, you know, the so-called war boys who apparently don't ever get to see the sun because they're see-through. we see the masses of people who are begging for water, and we see some rather large women who are chained to breast pumps. So in this universe where people are starving and don't have enough water and are being used for to pump breast milk, we care about the models and we must save the models. I got kind of mad, I'm going to be honest.
Like, oh my gosh.
Pissed me off. That's I know funny. That they're women, and don't get me wrong, I do not mean to make light of sex slavery. However, I presume, do we know how breast milk is produced? Women have to get pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't think that the women chained to the breast pumps had any choice in the matter. Like, let's not pretend that they did.
But
I think they're trying to say that's the future of these gals if they're not saved.
Is that maybe?
Oh,
I don't know. Maybe.
That's as maybe.
I
super spoiler alert, but the very end of the movie, I don't think it was accidental that it's the mothers who have been milked who turn on the water for all the people.
Okay. Well, it's implied that they did.
But no, you see them. They're
standing there. Quite frankly, I thought the ending was a bit of a mess because I'm like, okay, they arrive and everybody's cheering, but they don't know why they're cheering. Who told them what happened? And it's like, okay, take them up, great. And then suddenly the water flowing before that thing, because it was going to take forever for that thing to rise up, right? So the water's already flowing, and we see the women no longer chained to their breast milk feeding machine standing there as the water flows. There was no connection that they turned it on.
I assume that they turned it on because the handles are right there, which from the beginning of the movie when Morton Joe turns it on for 20 seconds and has people kill each other over a sip. I will say that since they didn't originally intend to come back and storm the Citadel, you have a valid point there. But in the end, they did end up coming back and setting everyone free and hopefully making a better life for everyone with ecofeminism, as it were.
Yeah. I like that. Well, I mean, it's not a deal breaker per se, but it really bothered me. And I'm just, since I have this platform, I'm going to use this as an excuse to air this grievance.
Sure, that's totally fair. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I will say I did appreciate that well, the models' introduction, they're all wearing like skimpy muslin. But I noticed upon, because the first time I watched it, I thought there were a bunch of close-ups actually on their legs and stuff like that. Actually, there's not. It mm-hmm. just looks like a fashion mm-hmm. shoot. Mm-hmm. Because we are so like trained to just believe this is how beautiful women hang out, right. like dousing themselves in water and like yeah. see-through white fabric.
But it doesn't do anything to really subvert that. They remain beautiful. But I will, the movie redeemed itself for me when they get to the other feminist haven.
And the biker broads saved them.
That was awesome. I loved that.
I thought that was excellent. What is really nice about a movie like this and that we don't see enough of is that there are many different kinds of women who have speaking roles in this movie. And so there is not one single woman that's supposed to represent all of us. So while you may not really approve of the wives or whatever, but there's something for all women in this movie, and that's awesome. Yeah. And we don't see enough of that, and I don't think that's fair. I mean, normally, most of these action movies, there's like one chick. In The General, there's only one chick.
Yes.
There's not even a lady background anywhere in there.
Well, thank you for bringing it back to the point at hand.
You're welcome.
Yes. there have been a number of critics who have pointed out the similarities between Mad Max, Fury Road, and The General.
That seems crazy to me. Honestly, really? I think there's more similarities between this film and Metropolis.
Okay, really? I
can
see that too.
I can definitely see that.
I can see that.
Yeah, it's definitely a dystopic.
Well, maybe in the beginning, but
in the end, too.
That's true.
The city.
Yeah. True, yeah. Come to think of it. And it's at the end of Metropolis, isn't there a flood? Am I crazy?
I don't remember.
I think
I've been wrong several times today.
But so. Just the structure of the film where they set off in one direction and they turn right back around, that's very okay. General-esque.
Right, but come on. There's got to be more than that, right?
Well, I think the thing that it's one long chase sequence. I mean, there is mm-hmm. not a lot of breathing room in Fury Road. I would certainly say you get like maybe 15 minutes somewhere in the middle and then you're right back on mm-hmm. the road mm-hmm. watching people die and burn in that right. ridiculous guitar contraption fly around.
Oh, I got so tired of that guitarist.
Really?
That was so lame.
I thought it was on just enough. Like, one more scene with it, and I would have been like, oh, my God, come on. Because yeah. when I remember, this is actually a movie where I saw the Mad Max trailer, and I don't want to see the movie. Because mm-hmm. We're about to get into CGI. But, like, the trailer had all of their CGI sequences, mm-hmm. and I felt like in the movie, like, it was much more palatable. Like, I actually couldn't tell unless I was really thinking about it, which parts were CGI and which weren't.
Well, before we get to that, let's point, like, so you really didn't see any similarities? Like, I think people are pointing to the scene where the guys are picking them off on sticks or whatever, and there's some acrobatic work going on, mm-hmm. like some really impressive stunt work.
You know what? Honestly, you could make that similarity between this and between The General and many films. You know, yeah. I can't think of one off the top of my head, but when I've heard that, I was like, what? This is similar. I said, honestly, it's just the only connection I see is going one, you know, on this one vehicle, if mm-hmm. you want to make that semi-truck with a tanker representative of The General, of the locomotive. Mm-hmm. Okay. But yeah. that's it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the dialogue in the film is really sparse, and it almost works as a silent film.
George Miller's goal. I actually would love to see it as an opera.
I would love to see an opera. It is almost
orchestrated.
A rock opera. It is.
So I think that would be excellent. But yeah, I think as far as similarities to The General, it's more that Mad Max owes The General a lot mm-hmm. in influence.
Yeah.
Than that, I think they purposely ripped off The General. but just that movie was so influential, which is why it's on the Sight and Sound list, that it could spark this kind of comparison
right.
nearly a century later.
I'm going to say that one critic said it and the rest of them jumped on the bandwagon.
Maybe
honestly.
So.
Somebody else went, ooh, that's neat.
I don't know. When I watched The General, I watched it and thought, like, if this had the Mad Max music, you could release it today. And someone on the internet, you know, leave it to the internet to actually synced up the Mad Max music to The General. So you can now watch.
Brilliant.
The General with the Mad Max score.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
But will it work the other way around?
That's a great question. Would it work the other way around? Probably not.
Yeah, I don't think so.
but I mean, when I think about the stunt work in Fury Road, I just think that Buster leaves the Cirque du Soleil folks in the dust, quite literally.
He did some really impressive work.
Well, not only that, but you can tell that the Buster Keaton stuff is actually real practical stunt work, whereas a lot of stuff on Fury Road, how much of that is wires? How much of that is CGI'd? How much of that is manipulated in post?
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, it's like
So does that matter to you guys, whether people actually put their lives on the line for the film?
I never want anybody to really put their lives on the line, but when you see something like Buster Keaton's films and you're like, there's no net here.
Yeah.
You know, the stuff that he's doing is pretty amazing. I'm not requiring that of a film.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, I'm all about safety. I've worked on too many shows as an assistant director where people needlessly got hurt. I mean, talk about women having a disadvantage. It's ridiculous. The shoes that actresses wear, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then a stunt woman has to go out and do the stunt wearing those shoes.
Yeah. Right. So, Jenna, what do you think? Do you appreciate it when stuntmen or women put their life on the line for a movie? Or at least you get the sense that they may have put their life on the line?
I prefer practical effects.
Okay.
Just generally. But on the other hand, all of this stuff is, like, escalated, so at this point, I don't know how you could make an action movie without killing someone if you were going to do all practical effects, and I don't want that.
Yeah. That's so big of you. You're such a good person.
It was pretty brave of her to say that, I think.
Yeah. So in that sense, I mean, I would like the CGI to be tasteful, but this really resonated with me, and in that sense, it is a lower footprint. Like, it's, you know, these roving bands of warriors in cars that they've cobbled together, and what I appreciated was the stuff that was real, and then I'm okay with them having, like, faux blown up a truck and stuff like that instead of actually endangering people.
Okay.
Well, and I think if we can sort of point out, it's not so much the danger, it's that when Keaton has to land in a hole or get caught by a crane, and it happens. It's like, holy smokes. But when we see it today, we're like, well, it's CGI.
Right.
It's planned.
Yeah,
they
were
totally
safe.
So it's not so much the danger factor. It's so much of the, whoa, he pulled that off factor.
There's definitely a craftsmanship that... But, I mean, on the other hand, like, Keaton also could have died from one of those stunts.
Absolutely.
Didn't he break his neck on
that? Oh, he broke his neck on in
Sherlock Jr.
Jr. with the water spout coming out to cool the train off in that film. Different train. Different film.
Okay.
And because it knocked him to the ground, and he walked around for like a week or something like that with a broken neck. And
I think it was longer. He didn't realize it was broken until he went back for another injury.
You're right. It was probably longer. And he also is known for having broken every bone in his body.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, you think about that, and, like, there's a combination of things. One, I would prefer that not happen. But two, also, legally, you just simply cannot get away with that at this point.
Yeah.
And that's probably a good thing. But there is an element of craftsmanship to watching all that stuff where it was the Wild West of stunt coordination. And you know, you could try it if you thought you could make it.
Well, and
sometimes it didn't work out well.
Well, and it's not like he was asking somebody else to do it.
Right. That's totally true. It was him doing it himself.
It wasn't, in which case, I think when you do a big film now, you never have the big stars.
Tom Cruise does all his own. But otherwise, I can't think of anyone.
But you also have
him. Thank you for mentioning that. That makes my intro much clearer.
You're welcome.
But you also have him, you know, with all sorts of harnesses and safety nets.
Right.
But in lieu of practical effects, we get CGI. I guess it's kind of a trade-off, but...
Well, I mean, blue screen happened for a really long time. Mm-hmm. I'm okay with blue screen. I just kind of, I like miniatures, like when that's a possibility.
Yeah.
I really like that. Well, and if Ray Harryhausen had been around, he probably could have done the train in the General without actually crashing
a
train, right?
I know,
I was
thinking that. Like, it's such a long shot. Like, did you really need to crash that train?
Funny is it almost, what's the word I'm looking for? The money isn't up there on the screen, as they say, because it almost looks like a miniature because there's nothing there to give perspective because they were being safe. There's no people around.
Yeah. Right.
So you can't tell that it's really happening, and it almost looks like 1/8 scale.
Yeah. Which is a shame.
So there's that. I will say one thing that is different, and I think I like it somewhere in the middle. But, like, in the General, you're looking at a lot of wide shots so you can see the stunt work. And in Mad Max, you're doing lots and lots of close-ups. One, so that to focus your attention on the action, but two, also, I think, to help aid in the safety safety quests so that you're shooting around wires and stuff like that. I thought Mad Max did it really well. I have gotten kind of annoyed with, like, the Batman movies and stuff like that where people are having a fist fight and I can't tell what's going on. It frustrates me greatly.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Because you can still do fight choreography without any CGI or wires unless it's a ninja movie where they're flying.
Right. But, like, I'm glad you mentioned something like The Dark Knight where – or other modern or other recent releases where it's clear that they're using – CGI, and it's all sort of shot in a very similar style. I feel like I've seen the same chase sequence at least 10 times in the last 5 years. But I'm wondering what distinguishes, like, a truly memorable chase sequence or action sequence from a run-of-the-mill sequence, which I feel... I mean, I don't want to be a negative person, but I just feel like I do feel like most chase sequences get kind of tiresome. But what distinguishes a really great chase sequence? Jenna, you're the expert.
Sure. I think there are a few different things. First of all, it needs to be well executed. I think something that cuts together well and that sort of you can follow really helps.
Mm-hmm.
But I think also there's I prefer a sense of humor in my action movies. Mm. And like if you were going to look at True Lies with
it's a great film. I like it very much.
It will be discussed.
Yeah.
So, but that's James Cameron satirizing his own genre. So he is just taking the piss out of action movies. But so remember the part where Eliza Dushku, like, jumps on the plane or the helicopter at the end and Arnold Schwarzenegger is trying to save her? Well, this was also done in Die Hard 4, but there's no humor in that and a lot of CGI. And it was just, like,
that
not
CGI
engaging
in Die Hard
at
4 was
all.
Horrible. Oh, my gosh.
It was horrific.
Yeah.
So, well, CGI is not necessarily a deal breaker because one of my all-time favorite chase sequences
Go on.
Is in the second Terminator film.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's so good. So good.
It's tough to pick my favorite chase sequence of that movie because they're all so good.
There are so many of them.
There are so many.
It's kind of one big chase movie.
It's like a two and a half, three hour movie.
Maybe that should be compared to The General.
Perhaps. Yeah. But when the T-1000 emerges from the fire after that sequence, like, that blew my mind. And while the CGI is very dated, it's still really cool because I think
the CGI has never bothered me in that film.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like CGI. There's no mistaking it. But it's okay to me. Yeah.
Just like the CGI in the original Star Wars before they fixed it up.
Right. I guess if it doesn't pretend to be
more than what it is.
Yeah, the pretense of verisimilitude or whatever that word is.
Well, you know, there's the old saying, if people are noticing stuff that's wrong, there's something wrong with your story.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So
and
if
I think
they're
that's
not.
True.
Yeah. And yeah. Exactly. And that's why I think Fury Road, there's a lot of problems with the story.
Right. I mean, aside from my issues with the models, like, I thought the story was small enough and contained enough that it didn't really bother me. Like, plot holes didn't bother me because it was such a, like, it seems like such an afterthought.
And it was much more engaging than, like, the Avengers where they're on some, like, planetary, like, war of attrition.
Yeah.
Anyway. But yeah, so I think that makes a big difference is just kind of having, like, losing some of the gravitas and, like, you know, realizing that your movie is not saving lives. You're there to entertain people.
Mm-hmm.
And that should be your first and foremost thought.
Okay. I guess we can list off a few of our all-time favorite chase sequences.
The French Connection. I love that. It's funny. One of my students, I said they had to borrow one of my movies from my collection. And because I know that my collection, they're not going to come across that sort of grouping of movies on their own.
Mm-hmm.
And the kid took French Connection. I said, awesome. Let me know what you think. And he came back and he said, you know, I found it kind of boring. Mm-hmm. I said, I totally understand. It's dated. It's from a different time period. We have to, what was it? When that film was made, the average shot time was 12 seconds. Mm-hmm. And now it's 6 or less.
Oh, yeah,
per
that
shot.
Makes sense.
So it's even the shots seem too long to linger.
But that's not a failing of the movie.
No, like, not at all. But it's interesting when somebody says, and I found, and I quote, this is what he said, and there seemed to be a lot of cliches. And I was like, Okay. First of all, you have to understand, clichés come from a place
right.
that people mimic, and that would be one of the films mm-hmm. that people mimic.
Mm-hmm. This is the original.
This is not a cliché.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so funny. Like, I watched the movie last night because I knew we were recording this, and that is probably the most famous chase sequence mm-hmm. ever. But I didn't think it was dated. I mean, it's dated in that it's very clearly a 70s film, but people revere the 70s mm-hmm. film. So it's very new Hollywood era, but those
well, I
are
think
the best,
people our
right?
age, I don't know how old your student is, I think people our age revere the 70s films. Okay. And some of them I feel conflicted about. Like French Connection, I could have used a little more character or story in that. I feel like mm-hmm. there's definitely this genre in 70s of this stoic
yeah.
man who has zero personality and just mm-hmm. goes and usually, spoiler alert, he dies at the end. But like, like mm-hmm. Le Samurai and all of those flicks mm-hmm. where it's just like, oh, God, give me something.
But yeah, so French Connection, it's a really long chase sequence. And it's in a movie where not a lot of that movie is just standing around.
You know what? But you mentioned earlier, Jenna, about the humor. You know, mm-hmm. you need to have some humor. There is some humor in that those
sure.
chases, especially when the guy he's chasing gets the upper hand.
Sure, absolutely.
And slyly looks at him through the subway window and just sort of tips his hat going,
right.
Didn't get me this time.
I mean, that the baby carriage thing.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's just
been seen in
yeah.
so many things. Oh, God, that just made me think of the Barbara Streisand movie, the fairy slaps. Yes,
What's
thank
up,
you.
Doc?
What's up, Doc?
I love that movie.
Yeah.
It's a great
I like that
movie.
Film, too.
Peter Bogdy. Jenna, the expert.
Oh, God. There are so many I like so much. Chase sequences.
Yes.
God, True Lies for sure, although there are multiple ones in that you could choose. You're making me think T2, though.
It's really good.
I know.
It's really good.
I know.
I think Cameron is so good at setting stakes and then raising them within a scene.
But True Lies, the bit with the horse is awesome. This is so fantastic. And one of the things I love about that film was the casting of Schwarzenegger and Jamie Lee Curtis. It's
Jamie
perfect.
Lee Curtis was fantastic.
Perfect.
In it. And also the opening is like a Bond movie.
Yeah.
Like, like the new Bond movies before
right,
they got
right.
that crazy. Like they like come in on snowmobiles mm-hmm. or whatever and like swim under an icy pond into like a glamorous party. It was bananas. It's so good.
But so True Lies, T2. Anything else?
You got to mention Indiana Jones films.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Sure. Those are terrific.
Yeah. So none of these are from the past 15 years, I'm noticing. We're
Ooh.
Not in...
You know what? I
thought Fury Road was really good, but
yeah.
I
think we're getting back to the whole practical versus
right.
And
CGI.
This is what... There is too much of a good thing with the CGI. Like, mm-hmm. it should be used sparingly, just like blue screen was. Just because mm-hmm. we have the technology doesn't mean we should... I mean, if you're going to make an animated film, just animate the goddamn thing. Mm-hmm. Don't.
True words have never been spoken.
Yeah. It's true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I would imagine, not that I've had the opportunity to direct something like this, but I would think for the actor and for the director to get someone. I know that on Mad Max, for example, Tom Hardy was reputedly an a-hole.
Right.
Because and George Miller apologized to him sort of after he had apologized. Because he was doing such quick shots and he had his game plan of how the film was going to get cut together.
Mm-hmm.
But it gave very little time for the actors to sort of emote or figure out their bearings in the scene.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so he really struggled with it. And I believe he and Charlize Theron will never be in a movie together again. So
interesting.
If anyone's listening, we prefer Charlize Theron for the Mad Max series. So let's have Furiosa back.
I liked Tom Hardy, though.
I thought he was
yeah.
fine, too. But if I have to choose, it's definitely Charlize.
Fair enough.
Sorry.
Fair enough.
Hey, you know, it'd be a perfect opportunity to hand off the torch. I mean, in a way, that shot at the end, he disappears into the crowd and she's
yeah.
left sort of leading. And
yeah.
Right.
Who knows? Maybe that was a handing off of the torch.
Yes. Right.
Furious Furiosa.
One can hope.
Fury Road Part 2. All the Furies. Now that we're all revved up from the hurtling cars and the explosions, let's take it down a notch with a touch of zen, aka our final notes of positivity. Carrie, what's one piece of culture, pop or otherwise, that you've been digging lately?
Well, I don't know about lately, but certainly because now it's summer, I am very, very excited about all the outdoor screenings that will be happening, not only in Los Angeles, but all across the country. It seems to be in the last couple of years, everybody has gone just crazy wild for doing outdoor screenings wherever they can. And I love it because most of the time it means they're doing classic films. And classic, as we know, just has to be 20 years or older. And they tend to stick to ones that are 20, like anniversary films. You know, people don't usually get excited about a 10-year anniversary film. It's usually like 20 or more. And then you oftentimes will get the cast visiting. And if it's a cast that maybe was big then and not so much now, then they're likely to show up because this is a fun event for them. But yeah, all the summer screenings, whether it's the Hollywood Forever Cemetery, you know, showing films on the side of the mausoleum, or going to actual old drive-ins that are defunct, but they're reopening because they can do it. Or I think they even, last year they did some along a part of the city with a bunch of not colonial, but like Victorian houses that all had the same like flat back. And so they projected them on the back of those houses because there were no windows, or if they did, they like boarded them up for the time. I was like, I'd never heard of it before. I was like, I have got to check this out. And there's also a lot of them happening at the beaches where they blow up a screen. Which I think is really smart and innovative. And it gets communities together during the summer. It's like the old-fashioned street block party with barbecues going on. So I'm really excited about summer outdoor movies.
Cool.
Love it. Jenna, how about you?
Well, I would say I've been watching a lot of television lately.
Oh, good.
And this sort of fits into, you know, our discussion. So as far as the Hollywood industry goes, people have bemoaned the loss of the sort of middle budget movie, and I actually was having a conversation with someone recently, and he's like, well, that's television now. And I was like, oh, I'm looking at this in a totally different light. I actually really respect the hell out of that, because they're doing some really great stuff on TV now, and that's pretty exciting. So Penny Dreadful would be one of the ones that I would definitely plug.
Penny Dreadful, I love that. Ava Green,
oh yeah, she is a revelation, and they give her all the scenery in the world she wants to chew up.
Perfect.
In that. Yeah. No, it's amazing.
All right. Penny Dreadful. I love it.
All right. Okay. So in preparation for this podcast, I mentioned that I watched the Mad Max movies. And while I'm not a huge fan of the series, I was reminded that Tina Turner is in Beyond Thunderdome. And I am a huge fan of Tina Turner. And so it was a great excuse to become reacquainted with her discography. And so I would just like to encourage everybody to go out and listen to really any Tina Turner, but especially anything she did with Phil Spector. I don't think that there's a better song in the world than River Deep, Mountain High. if it is, I mean...
If it is, it's by Tina.
It's probably by Tina, exactly. Yeah, so she's more than just a warrior queen. She is also an amazing singer, in case we'd forgotten.
You queen know. Of your heart,
yes.
Or your sound system, at least.
Always, always. Love me some Tina. I can't believe it's taken me this long to mention her on the podcast. Like, that's unacceptable. And that's the way we frame it, flicks-wise, that is. Listeners, what's your favorite chase scene? Come tell us on our website, flickswise.com. You can also like us and leave us a comment on Facebook, facebook.com/flickswise. You can follow me on Twitter. The handle is @flickswise. But most importantly, you should go and rate us and leave us a comment on iTunes. On our next show, we've got more death and violence, only slightly more cerebral. Tied for the 34th place on the Sight and Sound Critics poll, it's Alfred Hitchcock's 1960 feature, Psycho. In the meantime, Carrie, thanks for coming on the show again.
Thanks for having me again.
Jenna, welcome. Hopefully this will be the first of several appearances.
Oh, fingers crossed. Thank you.
All right, we're off to shake off some baddies. If you need us, we'll be harvesting weapons at Bullet Farm.